The year is 1984. I'm up at university studying philosophy, and I'm a passionate atheist. And this programme comes on the television called The Sea of Faith, presented by a Cambridge academic called Don Cupid. And it changes my life, changes the way I see things. Many people complained at the time that it was going to draw people away from faith. But for me, it had absolutely the opposite effect.
The Sea of Faith was once two at the full, and round Earth's shore lay like the folds of a bright girdle furled. But now I only hear its melancholy, long, withdrawing roar, retreating to the breath of the night.
The title, The Sea of Faith, was taken from Dover Beach, the famous 19th century poem by Matthew Arnold, which refers to the Victorian crisis of faith. A crisis that's shared, according to Don Cupid, by people in his own time too.
The New World owes its success to an insistently questioning, sceptical habit of mind which regards all beliefs as guilty till they're proved innocent. And this has had the effect of fatally undermining people's confidence in the old certainties that they used to live by. Today, many people don't know what to believe anymore. As a Christian, I want to know in what form, if any, Christian faith is possible for us today.
The Sea of Faith was a tour of Western thinkers, scientists, philosophers, historians, people like Nietzsche and Kierkegaard and Wittgenstein, and they all in their different ways posed challenges to Christian belief. At the time it was highly controversial. Letters came in objecting to it even before it went out. City Dean says God is dead, thundered the Cambridge Evening News.
Good morning. Our Tuesday call this morning arises out of a remarkable and controversial series on BBC television, The Sea of Faith, introduced by Don Cupid, who's Dean of Emmanuel College and...
I wish to ask Don Cupid, how can you be a Christian agnostic if you don't believe in the resurrection and Christ's divinity? How can you profess to be a Christian?
The series was presented by the Reverend Don Cupid, Dean of Emmanuel College, Cambridge, a theologian who, like the new Bishop of Durham, has upset many Orthodox Christians by his rejection of belief in the supernatural.
But in a way, I agree with the very first caller who was questioning whether Don Cupid could remain a Christian and yet take all the old Christian traditional beliefs in a metaphorical sense.
Well, Don Cupid, tell us what it does mean and justify your remaining a Christian.
God is spirit, God is love, God gives us...
This series had a huge impact on me, but what impact did it also have on other people? Did it lead people out of faith, or did it draw them back into it? Do the ideas that were presented 35 years ago still have resonance and importance today? Also, what happened to Don Cupid himself?
This is the Radio Times cover.
The Radio Times cover, and you're on the front page, there's a cross, a sort of...
Made in sand with the tide.
Again, Dover Beach reference.
Dover Beach reference, yes.
Sea of Faith. Don Cupid examines the ebb and flow of Christian belief in six programmes on BBC Two, Inside the Turn of the Tide. I'm in Oxfordshire, at the beautiful home of Peter Armstrong, who produced the series.
Well, I'd been working with Don Cupid through the 70s. We'd made some really interesting programmes, the culmination of which was a thing called Who Was Jesus, a two-hour BBC Two special. Then the question was, what do we do next? And around that time, there were some very big series being made by other departments in the BBC, notably Civilization on the Arts, The Ascent of Man about the story of science. So I was arguing to my bosses, we need the same thing on religion, and I think Don Cupid's the man to do it.
So who was Don Cupid? He was the Dean of Emmanuel College in Cambridge. He was a priest and he was a lecturer in the Divinity Faculty there. I've come to Emmanuel College to meet Catherine Pickstock, who was one of his students and is now the Norris Hulse Professor of Divinity.
Hello.
Very nice to meet you indeed.
I was just starting my theology degree and my Director of Studies said, I'm going to send you to Don Cupid, because he's very radical and you'll find that exciting. We used to call supervisions with him donologues. I don't know if you want to put that on the radio, you might not. Because he really would start connecting things up, and suddenly one was slightly incidental. And there really was nothing I could contribute. There were books all along the wall, and he would leap up and bring one down. And his grasp of the history of philosophy was just remarkable. You see it in the Sea of Faith programmes, this elasticity between periods and between authors, and the way he's able to synthesize disparate things and understand the connection. I mean, he was originally a natural scientist, and I sometimes think that he sees ideas as living beings, and he can see the sort of organic connection from one thing to another, almost like a creature.
So I'm Linda Woodhead, and I'm Professor of Religion and Society at Lancaster University.
You were a student of Dom's, weren't you?
Yes, he was the very first tutor I ever had, and he had something interesting to say about absolutely everything, from the ducks and the pond to the evolution of the species to God. He was the reason I went to Cambridge, actually. He was a very famous figure in his day. He was a celebrity, so people made pilgrimages to see Dom from all over the world.
I did.
Did you?
Yes.
Well, yes, and people forget now that this was a really big event.
You taught me at Theological College.
I taught you, Giles.
You did.
I hold no responsibility.
But I remember you being a much more conservative thinker back then. So did you sort of react against Dom a bit?
I was a funny mixture, I think. I think Don kind of sowed the seeds deep in me that grew later. And I was very influenced by Don when, quite early in my career, I turned from theology to sociology, because one of Don's great contributions was looking at ordinary language about God. He was very influenced by Wittgenstein, and he said, you know, theology should no longer be done from on high by people telling ordinary people what to believe and how to behave. We should be listening to ordinary people.
It's ages since I went to see Don Cupid back when I was a student. And I've tried to keep up with all the things that he's written. He's written 50 or so books over the time. We've corresponded over the years. We sent emails, but I've not actually seen him for over 30 years. So I'm really looking forward to seeing him again. He's 84 now, still lives in Cambridge with his wife, Susan. And I know his sight is failing and he can't get round very easily. But I'm sure about this, his mind will still be as sharp as a pin.
Can you squeeze in round
where
there?
Would you like me? Yes,
this is for me to see my life.
Oh, look, how nice is this?
Yeah. By the way, you've stopped appearing in The Guardian.
I have. Well, we're here to talk about God, Don.
Yeah. All right.
You were quite a pious youngster, weren't you?
I was very devout from the age of 14 when I was confirmed. I was so devout and so convinced that when I joined the army, the first night, I knelt down by my bed to pray. And the northern kids away from home for the first time shushed each other up and gave me a couple of minutes. And I was astonished that I behaved like that then and got away with it.
Yes.
But I did, and I remained very devout for a good while. But then I started to come out as a heretic because, on the whole, the supernatural doctrine of Christianity is all dead now and cannot be revived. Nobody can do it.
I'm a priest in the Church of England, and I practice in a rather traditional way. But when I say the creed, I regard it not as giving me supernatural information, but as showing me a way to walk in.
There'll be people who would have thought when you were preaching in Emmanuel, you had your fingers crossed behind your back.
No, it wasn't like that. I tried to preach honestly. I did once arrange for somebody to get up and contradict me while I was preaching, and we then conducted the rest of the sermon as a deliberate a staged debate. The congregation nearly had a heart attack. I've hardly ever been to a parish church which really fed the intellects of their parishioners. Most places expect you to just sit and listen passively to sermons which are of very low intellectual quality. And I do think it has starved the laity. There's no chance to find out what you yourself really think and say it in public.
It's funny, Don, because in a way you were responsible, and Sea of Faith and a lot of what you wrote, you were responsible for me becoming a clergyman. And I came up to see you and we had a conversation about it. I remember very well. But what I got from the Sea of Faith was something in a way more orthodox than you would articulate it now. This is what I would get. And because I read you as saying, look, God is not a thing.
Yes.
And theologians have been saying God is not a thing for a very long time.
Yes.
And that actually, that there's still a way of believing in God without believing that God is a thing.
Yes. So I was, I think, saying at that time, you can still sort of keep belief in God, especially as a spiritual goal, but you can't produce God as a theory to explain why it's the world, because you can't test that by the method of science.
You've just described where I've remained, probably.
Yes, still are. Yes, still are.
That's probably where I stand. But you've moved away from that position as well.
I would now say God is voluntary.
What he's doing is opening up all human knowledge as available to scepticism, not just religious knowledge.
Catherine Pickstock.
That's sort of what Sea of Faith did for me, is show these infinitely receding horizons, so you can't grab hold of any horizon because it will cede place to another. And so he was making things mysterious again because they had become tediously dogmatic.
Exactly right.
Why should we worship that God who's this monstrously powerful creature with certain rules and some hideous will that will suddenly decide randomly to intervene in the world?
Yes.
He was right to criticise that. And so he was showing that everything is unknowable, not just divine things, but human, earthly things too.
And there's something, isn't there, very sort of, there's a sort of orthodoxy about it, which people don't get.
I know. But what he's saying is what Aquinas would say, or Julian of Norwich. It wasn't some, you know, mad,
newfangled
hippie thing to say. No. It was actually medieval. It was Platonic.
It's absolutely clear to me that Don Cupid touched a nerve. He was saying things that the church was really nervous about. And it had this extraordinary effect when people heard it for the first time. It was like pulling the ring off a can of Coke. There was this sort of explosion of energy that came out. And you can see that in all of the letters and all of the communications that Don had afterwards. Here we are, the Sea of Faith room in Gladstone's Library in North Wales, and there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. Box files, correspondence, brackets, unsorted, relating to the programme. Okay, let's just get one of these out. I would like to thank you from the depths of my heart.
I rebuke you in the name of Jesus Christ of Nazareth for the disrepute you have brought to his name. You who call yourself a Christian philosopher are very much accursed. Accursed. Accursed.
Dear Dean, your television programme tore me apart. One moment I was quietly watching a sitcom on the small screen in my front room. The next moment I was hoisted out of my armchair, seized by the throat, shaken till my teeth rattled. All my assumptions about Christianity were in pieces. It was a religious mugging.
Dear Reverend Cupid, I have found your series The Sea of Faith very helpful. I could not accept a lot of the traditional Christian thinking and felt hypocritical when taking Holy Communion or even going to church. Now that I've had my private thoughts and those of my husband expressed in a public way by a minister of the church, I feel a new spiritual confidence.
As an old friend and colleague, it's with great sadness that we feel we have to take a stand against views which we see as explicit atheism, which we believe may do much harm to fringe Christians who watch the programme.
You know, at the time, there were people who were saying, oh, this is just sort of atheism in waiting. I mean, they sort of maybe were right.
No, I think that's completely wrong.
Linda Woodhead.
Dom absolutely was not atheism in waiting. What Dom was offering was a different vision for the church and Christianity, which, had it taken it, wouldn't be in the parlous state it is now. Don't forget, the Church of England, which Don belongs to, has more than halved since the Sea of Faith went out. I mean, it's completely collapsed. And Don was a lone voice, really. He saw that. He prophesied that. He said, it can't go on like this. And it has to radically reform itself. And it's built on a delusion that people can know an unknowable God outside of language. And it has to rethink that. So both kind of metaphysically and ethically, Don offered a really fresh way that didn't give up on Christianity at all.
The reaction to Don Cupid was, in many quarters, quite visceral. Some people saw him as public enemy number one, undermining the faithful. In academic quarters, there were all sorts of books and articles published refuting him. The church distanced itself from him. How did this affect Don Cupid personally? Actually, he's remarkably reticent to talk about that, but I think there's a sort of premonition in the Sea of Faith series itself. And that's the bit where he starts talking about David Strauss, 19th century theologian, and the reaction to his book about the life of Jesus. I'm watching it again with Peter Armstrong.
This is about David Strauss and his book, Life of Jesus.
Yet he remained a Christian. He'd no doubt of the historical existence of Jesus.
Think about it as if it's Don's book.
The early Christian beliefs about him were expressions valid in their day of moments in the spiritual life of every one of us. It did him no good. When the book appeared, all hell broke loose. After Volume 1 came out in June 1835, Strauss was dismissed. No theologian of repute could defend him publicly, and he couldn't even visit his friends for fear of injuring their reputations. He never held another full-time job. Some people regarded him as the Antichrist.
So I thought that was rather redolent of Don's own experience.
When you started with all this theological experimentation, how did the sort of church hierarchy react?
I simply became an ex-person instantly.
An ex-person.
Those of my friends who were or were becoming bishops had to break their acquaintance with me completely. So I found myself isolated and marginalised. Of course, once you're retired, you can't be touched.
It's extraordinary how bishops, you hear bishops preach after they stop being bishops, and they end up being 10 times more radical than whenever they were.
I had a letter from the third senior bishop in the church, I mean the fourth senior, signed and dated the day of his retirement, expressing warm support for my views. A while ago now.
It must have been quite hurtful.
Yes, I never got any higher degree or any promotion academically. I was just cut out. I didn't even have research students for a decade. And it was even the case that people who wrote their PhDs on me couldn't write them in Cambridge.
So, just to be clear, it wasn't just the church that found what you were saying difficult, but the academy as well.
Yes, but it doesn't matter. That's normal. That's par for the course, really. My own thoughts gave me a bad time. I had lengthy periods of poor mental health. But I now think it was not the fault of the institutions, but probably more likely my own, because you also accuse yourself. Remember, the heretics of the past often stuck their hand into the flames. But to get to new places in religion and in spirituality, you have to pay a heavy price.
Don Cupid doesn't want my sympathy, but I do feel that he has been unduly punished for doing what a priest and a theologian really ought to do, which is opening up the big questions about life, the universe and everything. But for me, the deeper question is whether the way in which he opened up these ideas is still helpful to us, whether they were a bit of a period piece of the 1980s, whether these are the questions that people are asking these days, whether he's taken us on in our thinking or slightly left us stranded with a set of questions that were important in the 1980s, but are no longer the questions that people are asking today. Alistair McGrath is the Professor of Science and Religion at the University of Oxford.
There's no external reality for Don Cupid. It's simply about how you feel. It's about how you choose to represent things. It is an ethic and a religious philosophy of radical individualism. And for those who like that kind of thing, well, that's great. But for the rest of us, we're just saying, well, look, what about the communal dimension? What about the whole area of being able to talk to each other and have an idea of what we're talking about? I think that's something that Cupid in many ways misses.
I mean, one of the things I put to him, actually, and this comes from an old lefty like myself, is that there may not have been some great coincidence that at the time he was exploring Sea of Faith, this was when individualism was becoming even more embedded into the way in which we looked at the world politically and socially and so forth. And this was just another extension of it.
I think there's a lot in that. We were in a culture that was characterized by this radical individualism. You have Richard Dawkins' book, The Selfish Gene, came out slightly earlier. You've got the political situation in Britain, Margaret Thatcher and everything like that. And in many ways, what Don Cubitt was doing is saying, here is a religious way of looking at things that is the product of an individual mind, and you believe what you believe, I believe what I believe. There's no external reality to which we are beholden, and there is no external criterion by which that can be validated. He's in effect allowing you to find a religious way to personal fulfillment without reference to any external norms or indeed any institutions.
I think Alistair McGrath has put his finger on something here. This is the trouble I have with Don Cupid's work. It makes everything all about me. And the whole point about Christianity, well, it seems to me, is that God is other, that it's not all about me. It's not all about my inner world and my inner workings. And there's also something else that troubles me, and this is well put by David Ford, who's the former Regius Professor of Divinity at the University of Cambridge.
I remember watching Don perform in this very direct and clear way again. I mean, he was offering a very neat, encapsulated history of modernity in relation to faith, really. I remember thinking it was also making an assumption that thing was one way. The metaphor of the sea, the tide going out. Now, of course, tides come in as well. And you would never guess that during all that period, there was at least 80% of the world's population were directly related to the world's major religions. And that this is still the case. I think Britain is complexly multi-religious and multi-secular, and it's got more pluralist. And a linear, one-directional, secular view of modernity doesn't do justice at all to the pluralism of modernity.
You see, the thing is about the 20th century is that it actually saw the largest growth in religious belief the world has ever known. Religion actually exploded in the 20th century. Far from the tide going out, globally at least, the tide came in. And that's also true, it seems to me, of the 21st century, where religion, far from becoming less important, has become more important in the way in which we think about the world. And this has raised a whole load of different questions. In the 21st century, we're bothered about the role of women, we're bothered about religion and violence. We are not quite asking the same questions that they were asking in the 19th century and that Don revives for the 1980s. Of course, the inner existential wrestling which characterised the Sea of Faith will always be a part of most people's religious quest. And there will always be Christians who will need help to think about the nature of God and what Christianity really means. As Peter Armstrong reminds me, there are still groups of people up and down the country who meet together to explore where Don Cupid took them.
Perhaps what was most surprising was that it actually led to the formation of a whole movement, the Sea of Faith Network. And this was groups of people who even today still meet for conferences and around the country, small conferences in Australia, New Zealand, as well as the UK, to actually say, well, look, something important is being said here. There's a question here which we need to discuss and actually explore what the future of Christianity could be.
Christianity was always going to develop into secular humanism. God becomes human in the world and dies. And nowadays, all we can be sure about is the human world and human language. And we invented every bit of our knowledge, every word in our language. Everything is human, man-made. So nowadays, I don't think there's any real world at all. There's no meaning out there, no knowledge out there, no truth out there, no reality out there. There's only the human world. But it's not a prison. It's just all there is.
Well, when did you stop seeing yourself as a member of the Church of England?
About 6 or 7 years ago, after a lifetime of being a nearly daily communicant. So I don't actually belong to any church other than Sea of Faith itself.
Do you miss church, going to church?
I do, rather. I do. So instead of theology and the church, I now talk rather about the sanctification of life.
It's like Tolstoy, a little bit.
The religion of life. Yes. These are things that Pierre says towards the end of War and Peace. Life is God. To love life is to love God.
The point I would like to make is that Don, to me, remains the most Christian person. My goodness, everything about him still speaks Christianity. Of a Protestant type. You know, here I am, I can do no other. I'm going to stand up for truth, even though I'm going to be martyred for that in my own career and what I wanted for myself. And I'm going to selflessly outpour myself, like the sun. He talks about solar ethics and self-giving. Well, how Christian is that? And that's absolutely what he's lived.
That's not how I see Christianity, but it doesn't really matter. It's not the role of the theologian to be overly concerned with orthodoxy. I have a lot to thank Don Cupid for, and in particular for raising the question of God in such a way that I sat up and took notice and had to give it some sort of answer. Don made theology feel like an adventure, a dangerous adventure. And in our management-obsessed church and our overly footnoted academy, it's important to have people to stimulate and to provoke. The idea that a theologian might be a provocateur, well, it doesn't feel like there's enough of them these days. The fact that we ended up in different places is neither here nor there. Without his encouragement, I wouldn't be where I am today, and there are a lot of other people who would say exactly the same. I love this letter, and it really is from Tunbridge Wells. I must add one small voice to the chorus of thanks for the Sea of Faith. A very deeply felt thank you for the happiness, for the affirmation of life as spirit and love spoken into one's natural ears sitting in one's old armchair. And it ends, bless you, joy bringer. Bless you, joy bringer. Thank you.